In the third week of our series, Return with Great Joy, our series, Return with Great Joy, actually comes from the end of the book of Luke. And the end of the book of Luke, we see that the disciples return back to Jerusalem after Jesus has been crucified and resurrected. And as they return back to Jerusalem, the scene of the crucifixion, the scene where all their hopes were dashed, they come back with great joy. And so we believe that we can learn something from the disciples. How do they return back to Jerusalem with great joy? Well, we believe that we can return as life sort of comes back to normal after COVID. I know many of us are in different states of that, right? For many of us, COVID is more or less done. For some of us, we're right in the thick of it. But for all of us, we are returning back to kind of a normal life. So how do we do it with great joy? Now, that's what we are talking about. And we're in a third week. We've been looking at the last four episodes of life after the resurrection in John 20 and 21. And we're going to look at John 21 today. But before we do that, I have a little bit of a story to tell you. All right. According to a recent survey on the general state of American happiness, guess what? Probably no surprise to you. We are happy, less happy, I guess. Less happier. How do you say that? Less happy than we've ever been. And now this survey came out before COVID, so I can't even imagine where we're at now. But the interesting thing is, there is research done about unhappiness. All right. So in the mid 2000s, Harvard researcher Daniel Gilbert published a book on happiness. Okay, and in this book, he says that our unhappiness boils down to basically this. The human being thinks about the future more than it does about the present and the past. So we think about the future about 1 in every 8 hours in general, and it affects our happiness because we're really bad at it, as it turns out. When people daydream about the future, Gilbert writes, they tend to imagine themselves achieving and succeeding rather than fumbling or failing. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Also, he writes, researchers have discovered that when people find it easy to imagine an event, they overestimate the likelihood that it will actually occur. So all of that works together to lead us, as Gilbert tells us, to be unrealistically optimistic about our futures. So the reason why we're unhappy is because we imagine the futures. We imagine ourselves succeeding. We imagine ourselves scoring the winning goal. We imagine ourselves getting the job. We imagine ourselves being reciprocated in our breathless admissions of love. I love you. Do you love me too? We've never even talked, you know. Then we arrive in the future, and the future actually becomes the present. And the present doesn't match the future that we imagined, and we're disappointed. Anybody have any experience with this? Anybody ever imagine the future? Think of yourselves as succeeding in the future. Then you get to the future becomes the present, and you're like, what just happened? Anybody ever have any experience with this? I know I do. I have so many experiences of this, which I won't actually name. It would be really embarrassing to me. I've imagined getting the job, then haven't gotten it. I've created fantasies about how the things I've created will be received, only to be disappointed. I've made up elaborate stories of what the future will be like, only to arrive in the future and look around and go, what just happened? I imagined this much differently. This is probably why Jesus tells us, therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. And why James tells us later, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. Maybe spending so much time thinking about the future is part of what it means to be fallen or broken. But you know, our unhappiness is not just anchored in the future, right? It's also moored in the past. We all know that we can't go back to the past. We all probably know people who live in the past. Does anybody know anybody who lives in the past, lives so much in the past? Perhaps this is why the Apostle Paul tells us forgetting what is behind. Anybody know anybody who lived their best years in high school? Anybody know anybody who tries to live high school as if they were 30? Anybody know anybody like that? Yes, we do. We're not going to actually point, okay? We're just going to acknowledge that that happens. So on the one hand, we can't live moored in the past. On the other hand, when we fixate on the future, we can oftentimes be unhappy. We ask ourselves, what are we going to do after all this ends? We dream about all the ways that our lives will change. We think about the people that we'll see. We think about the vacations we'll take, the jobs we'll return to, the restaurants we'll go to. But what happens when we arrive in the future and we find ourselves disappointed? Because the future we imagine after COVID is actually not all that great. What if all of the problems we've discovered about ourselves during COVID actually don't go away when COVID goes away? What if the future is actually unhappier than last year? Isn't that a sad thought? I mean, look, if you find yourself maybe stuck in the past or living too much in the future, I don't blame you. It's actually really difficult to live in the present. In fact, one of the ways that the forces of evil, as the Apostle Paul tells us, the forces of evil in the world tempt us is they tempt us to live outside of the present. C.S. Lewis writes this in the Screwtape Letters. The Screwtape Letters is a book, a fictional account of two letters between demons. Now, doesn't that sound interesting if you've never read the Screwtape Letters before? That might be something interesting to pick up. Letters between demons. So this is what C.S. Lewis writes. Our business is to get humans away from the eternal and from the present. With this in view, we sometimes tempt a human, say a widow or a scholar, to live in the past. But this is of limited value, for they have some real knowledge of the past, and it has a determinate nature, and so to that extent resembles eternity. It is far better to make them live in the future. Biological necessity makes all their passions point in that direction already. So that thought about the future inflames hope and fear. Thought about the future inflames hope and fear. Also, it is unknown to them, so that in making them think about it, we can make them think of unrealities. In a word, the future is, of all things, the least like eternity. This is what C.S. Lewis says as he's writing from the perspective of a demon. Okay, so let's try to get humans to not think about the present, is what these demons are saying. But that's what we're left with. We're left with, if we can't live in the future, if it's not helpful, if Jesus tells us, you know, therefore do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself, and if fixating on the past is not any way to live, then we're left with the future that, or the present, which is the very thing that C.S. Lewis is saying these demons are trying to get us not to think about, right? We're left with the eternity of the present. We're left with the present where the eternal resurrected Jesus is. If we're going to have joy in the return, then here is where we must have him, the present. And it's here that Peter and Thomas and Nathaniel, James and John, and two other disciples meet him. So in your programs or on the screen, we're going to turn to John chapter 21, and we are going to read the first 14 verses. So afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon told them. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. Simon Peter is always jumping into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. So here are Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, a couple other disciples, it's 7 of the 11, and they're in Galilee, of all places, north of Jerusalem. They're in Galilee. And why are they in Galilee? Because Jesus told them to go there. Jesus says in Matthew 28:10, "Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee." And so they did. We know that before Jesus called these disciples, they were, anybody? Fishermen. They were fishermen. And though they had just seen the resurrected Jesus, I'm almost certain they have no idea what's going on. So they're thinking, okay, so you come back. So this whole program of upturning Rome, that's what we're going to do, right? Nobody tells them to go back to Galilee. And so they go back to Galilee, which must have been super confusing. That's where they're from. Why not stay in Jerusalem? No, they're back in Galilee. So they start looking at each other and going, what do we do now? So are we starting back at the beginning again? Maybe we should fish. How are we going to feed our families? We need to make some money. You know, we know how to fish, so let's fish. So they fish all night. It's a familiar sea to them. They've probably trawled it every day, and none of their fishing spots are working for them. They catch nothing. The sea, the thing that they've made their livelihood for most of their lives turns up nothing. They went there because in the past, it gave them a lot of fish, so they thought that it could be their future. But all they got was water. All they got was the sea. But that's exactly what the future and the past hold. They hold the sea. You know, I recently did this Twitter poll about where people wanted their first, like, real vacation in celebration of the end of the pandemic, where they wanted it to be, and I listed a bunch of different options. I listed, you know, the sea or the ocean. I listed the city, and I listed, I can't remember what else I listed. Those are the only two options I really think of, I guess. But guess what people picked? They picked the sea. They picked the ocean. We love the sea, don't we? I mean, how many of us love the water? We love going to the water. We love going to the beach. You know, we love, like, sitting on the beach. We love getting hot. And then we love going into the water after we've gotten hot. You know, if you have small children, you know that they love the water, right? We love the sea. We think the ocean is great. We think it's relaxing. My wife loves water. She wants to live close to water. She loves going to the lake on her morning runs. But here's the interesting thing. The sea was not like that for the first century Jew. They didn't think the sea was relaxing. They thought the sea was chaos. The sea represented chaos to them. The sea was where sea monsters like Leviathan lived. The sea was the unruly wildness of nature. The sea was the thing they couldn't control. So when Jesus calmed the sea, the disciples were like, whoa, this person is really someone. Calming the sea. And the chaos of the sea, if you think about it, I mean, it's sort of like our future, isn't it? It's like that. It's like random. It's like chaotic. What's going to happen? We don't know what will happen tomorrow. Anything could. I mean, that's why I think there's a lot of anxiety today. The reason why there's a lot of anxiety today is because we are living in an information age. So we basically know everything that could possibly happen to us tomorrow. We basically know it, right? And most of what we know that will happen to us tomorrow is bad. That's what we know from the information age. So the information age tells us two things. It tells us what will happen tomorrow and tells us everything bad that could happen tomorrow. So that's why we're anxious. We are, as C.S. Lewis says, both inflamed by hope and more like fear. So what is left to the disciples is the eternity of the present, just as we were saying at the beginning of this message, the eternal resurrected Jesus in our present. In the present, the enormous power, comfort, and friendship of Jesus is here and now. In the present, Jesus is calling to his disciples from the shore where he is. It wasn't the past, going back to their old lives, that enabled them to be joyous. It wasn't the future, where people, where the disciples are made to think of unrealities. It's the present in which Jesus appeared, the present that made Jesus, that made Peter jump out of the boat and swim to shore. What does Jesus have for us in the present? Three things. First thing, friendship. So what does he call the disciples from the shore? He calls them friends. I mean, friendship is the theme of John's biography of Jesus, and I think it's an under-realized, under-emphasized reality for today. Friendship. We think of friendships as lower than family relationships. We think of them as disposable. You know, we think like, well, you know, I can leave my friends. They're not my family after all. It's not necessary to stick with your friends as you do with your family. Blood is thicker than water, as we say. But I don't think this is the way Jesus thought about friendships. Jesus says in John 15, greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's, everybody, friends. Notice he doesn't say family, he says friends. There's no greater love than laying down your life for a friend. Could it be possible that at the heart of the church, the closest, most intimate relationships are not necessarily nuclear families, but are friendships instead? And also think about this. We don't know the future. I mean, it's like the seed before us, like chaos, right? But we've got something far better. We don't have a crystal ball, but in our friendship with Jesus, he lets us in on the secrets of the kingdom. I no longer call you servant. This is what he says in John 15. Instead, I have called you, well, I no longer call you servants because the servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you, everybody say it with me, friends. For everything that I have learned or that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You might not have a crystal ball to tell the future, but you do have a God who knows you and is Lord over the world and has made known to you his business because you are his friends. We know what he's up to. We've been given gifts, like even the gift of prophecy, to uncover the secrets of people's hearts for their good. We even know the ultimate end of the story, don't we? We know what will happen at the end of history. We know that the end of time will be a lot like the beginning of our world. We know that the world will eventually bend toward Eden. We will live in a garden as Adam and Eve did, but this time with a throng of people. It will be a garden city. I know this might be a little bit difficult to wrap our heads around. I mean, like, we are friends with Jesus, and that's greater love, even greater than being called sisters and brothers. But think about this for a moment. Take a moment and think about your closest friends. Doesn't this ring true for you? Don't you share more with your closest friends? Don't you cry more with them? Don't you grieve more? Don't you laugh more? I remember when I was at a ceremony and my dad and my dad's best friend and his brother, who is closest in age to him, were both there. And I remember my dad getting up to speak. And I remember my dad actually honoring his best friend over his brother. And I thought, man, that just seems wrong to me. But I just wonder, was it actually more right? Maybe not to honor one person over the other, but to just valorize the closeness between these two friends. There is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. I mean, my dad lasts more with his friends. I mean, and that speaks to another reality. I mean, like, why do we get together with our friends? Don't they give us joy? Don't our closest friends actually make us happier? Isn't that true? Have you experienced that? You know, why do you get together with your friends? You don't think, well, these are the people that make me miserable. I think I'll spend a lot of time with them. No. We get together with people who we like. We get together with people who give us joy. I mean, we couldn't bear to face life without them. That's why we put a lot of our friends in our quarantine bubble. How many of you did that when we were in quarantine bubbles? Do you remember that? How many of you put some friends there? How many of you thought, well, if it's just my family, I'm going to go crazy? Did anybody think that? I'm going to go insane if it's just people that are related to me. I'm going to need to actually have some people that I like. No, I'm just not just people that I love, but people that I really like to be around. But the return with great joy is possible because in the present, if we're in a quarantine bubble or not, and beyond, is someone who will stick closer to us than any earthly friend. It's our friend Jesus, the resurrected Jesus who laid down everything for us, including his own life. Right now in the present, that friend is calling to us from the shore to leave the chaos of the sea and be with him. The other thing that Jesus has for us in the present is he has attention to our needs. So the disciples fish all night. They catch nothing. They're tired. They're hungry. And I mean really hungry. I mean, if you spend all night, anybody ever have an all-nighter? Does anybody remember those all-nighters? For those of us who were in college, have you spent time all night and realized this is really not smart what I'm doing? I'm doing this right before a test. And I'm going to go to that test, and I'm going to be half asleep. But what happens when we actually deprive ourselves of sleep? Well, studies show that when we deprive ourselves of sleep, we eat. Anybody deprive yourselves of sleep and just find yourself eating? Anybody ever do that? I mean, that's what actually happens when you deprive yourself of sleep. And so here, the disciples fishing all night, they catch nothing. They're probably really tired, and they're really hungry. So what does Jesus bid them to do? He says, come and have breakfast. Jesus is not unaware of our physical needs. Jesus, in the present, attends to them, even the most basic, most everyday of our needs. He attends to the people of Israel, do you remember? Giving them manna from the ground to break into bread. Do you remember that? He attends to Elijah, giving him baked bread and water after the prophet flees for his life. He attends to Jonah, giving him a plant to sit under when the sun rises with scorching heat. And he attends to disciples who have fished all night. You know, our needs do not go unnoticed by Jesus either. Whatever troubles you, whatever you lack, there is an invitation in the present to ask Jesus to help you. Maybe you've lost your keys. Pray. Maybe you need food. Maybe you need rent. Maybe you need some kind of provision. Pray. Miraculous provision can arrive in the moment in the present because of the eternal resurrected Jesus in the present. Our immediate needs are not ignored in the present. You know, the myth of Gnosticism tells us that what matters most is our soul or our spirit. Gnosticism tells us that we must escape our mortal cages, our bodies, to experience fully the reality of the eternal. But friends, Gnosticism is not the gospel. Jesus invites us to have breakfast with him. Come and eat. Your body matters. And oh, by the way, we might do well to remember what happens after this, which Renee is going to preach about next week. Peter tells us to do what? Feed my lambs. Peter's told to feed my lambs. What does that mean? Well, Gnosticism would tell us that means feed them spiritually. Feed their souls. But maybe what Jesus is saying is he's saying both. Feed their souls, but feed their bodies too. I mean, if you don't find yourself needy, if you don't find yourself needing a meal, maybe what that means is that means that in the present, there is an invitation to ask somebody to have breakfast with you. Maybe there is an invitation to do as the eternal Jesus does. Part of the joy of the return is that we're invited to give, to meet needs, to attend to one another. It is more blessed to give than to receive. So who might you invite to come have lunch with you after the service? In a socially distanced way, wearing a mask. Who might you invite to come and have breakfast with you? All right, the last thing that Jesus has for us in the present is a blessing to our labor. All right, so the disciples caught nothing by themselves. With Jesus, they hauled in 153 fish. This is the hopeful promise of the eternal breaking into the present. Our labor is blessed, right? So what's the significance of Jesus telling them to cast their nets on the right side of the boat, 100 yards from shore? Does it mean that they didn't think to do that? Were they in the boat thinking, if we had just thought about the right side of the boat, we would have caught tons of fish? Nope, it doesn't mean that, I don't think. I mean, they're experienced fishermen. They would have thought there's a left side and a right side. We should probably do both if we're not catching things on the left side. No, they catch all of this fish because the Lord of the Sea of Chaos, the resurrected Jesus, causes the sea to give up its fruit. And we can return with great joy because this is the promise of doing things in the present at the direction of the eternal resurrected Jesus. Fruit. In Jesus, if we abide in him, we will bear fruit. In Jesus, if we are with him in the present, if we are with him and we found our lives on him, if we listen to him, if we follow the nudges of his Spirit, we will bear fruit. If we do not, then we probably will catch nothing. I mean, we want to be fruitful, don't we? I mean, who doesn't want to be fruitful? Who doesn't want to have meaning? And their good efforts and action rewarded with good results. I mean, who doesn't want that? We all want that, right? So how can we secure a fruitful future? By focusing on the resurrected Jesus in the present. I mean, and listen, let's be honest. We're not going to catch 153 fish, probably. But that doesn't mean that it's not miraculous or will be. So Abraham followed a nudge, left his homeland. He became the father of many nations, even though he had one kid when he was near 100. Philip followed a nudge to ask the Ethiopian eunuch what he was reading. That eunuch would be the first of many, many Gentile converts. Ananias followed a nudge and prayed for Paul to be healed of his blindness. Paul would go on to become the greatest missionary the church ever had. It's fruit. They paid attention in the present, and the little nudges of the Spirit, even though those actions might have seemed silly or dangerous at the time. So in our present, too, we can listen and bear fruit. I remember following a nudge to lean into a friendship with a person a couple years ago. I was just following a nudge. Later, that person would go on to become one of my best friends. Later, that person has made more impact on the way I think about spiritual formation than any other person I know. We do not know the future, friends. We do not know the future. We cannot live in the past. But we can do this. We can trust that our little actions in the present that seek to respond to the invitations of the resurrected Jesus will bear fruit. And Jesus tells us in John 15 that bearing fruit makes our joy complete. So three things: friendship, attention to our needs, and a blessing to our labor. That's what he has for us in the present. You know, every week these series, we picked a spiritual practice to couple with these stories and what they teach us. Because we believe that to change, it's not just to hear and listen to somebody preach a message and to put something in your head that will actually make a change. I mean, how many of you have ever, like, put something in your head, learn something, but it actually didn't make any change in your life? How many of you have ever had that experience? So we believe that change is more than knowing. We believe that transformation is about doing, but doing in the presence of God. And so that's why we pick these spiritual practices. We think they're really important. Our first week with Mary Magdalene, we practiced the prayer of examine. Last week, we prayed through our doubt. Well, this week, we're going to practice being present in the present with Jesus through a spiritual practice called practicing the presence from a monk named Brother Lawrence. So Brother Lawrence wrote this slim volume on this practice in the late 1800s. And in it, he tells us to direct our present attention to the consciousness of God's presence with us. This is what he writes. The presence of God is an applying of our spirit to God or a realization of God as present, which is borne home to us either by the imagination or by the understanding. Brother Lawrence was this monk who who was tasked with washing dishes. He was tasked with these ordinary duties of washing dishes and turning those dishes over. And in those common duties, he directed his attention to God, and he received God's love in the present. And so that's what we're going to ask you to do. God and Brother Lawrence had friendship with one another. God and Brother Lawrence, there was an attention to Brother Lawrence's needs. And there's also a blessing to all of his labor. We're going to send you some information about how to do that this week through the weekly emails. If you've not gotten those or you're not subscribed to them, you could subscribe to them. We'll send you an email with some more detailed instructions about it. But this is one of the ways that we think about embracing the truth that God is actually with us in the present, that Jesus is with us in the present, that resisting the future and not fixating on the past is a way to return with great joy. So that's what we're going to do this week. So let's pray as I invite Jess to come on up here. Jesus, we are so thankful for your friendship with us. We are so thankful that you meet our needs. And we're so thankful that as we listen to you and we follow your nudges, you will bless our labor. Be with us this week as we seek to lean into your presence. Amen.